WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
Mushrooms are very strange. Portobellos are so tasty and so large, they're now sometimes served as the main course. On the other hand, some mushrooms are toxic enough to kill you. Others bring hallucinogenic visions. Three mushrooms once grew on my kitchen ceiling, but we'll get to that in a minute. My guest, George Hudler, is the author of the new book, Magical Mushrooms, Mischievous Molds, about the fungus kingdom and its impact on our lives. Hudler is a professor of plant pathology at Cornell University. Before we get to the mushroom's place in the fungus world, let's see what makes a fungus a fungus.
First of all, is that the fungi don't have any chlorophyll, so that they have no way to make their own food. They need complex organic molecules as sources of food. They can't do that themselves. That's what makes them different from plants. Secondly, is that they have a relatively simple structure. There are no roots, stems, leaves, brains, legs, arms. The fungi are quite simple. There is a little bit of specialization, but it's not a tremendous amount. Then a third feature to separate fungi from some smaller microbes is that they are comprised of cells. The cells do have cell walls, which is different actually from animals, but the cell also has a nucleus, and that's what makes the fungus different from a bacterium. And then finally, the fact that fungi do reproduce by way of spores. And that's, there are other organisms that do that, but that feature taken together with no chlorophyll, simplified structure, and just the general nature of their growth habit makes them unique as a kingdom.
I'll confess that one of the reasons why I wanted to do this interview is that one day, when I was renting an apartment, this was several years ago, I looked up at the ceiling of my apartment to find three mushrooms growing on it. And I was just appalled. I thought, this is a dream and I'm going to wake up, because mushrooms don't grow on the ceilings of apartments. What were those mushrooms doing on my ceiling? I should say that I did have a leak.
Uh-huh. Well, that's exactly why they were growing. They were mushrooms, fruit bodies, that is, of fungi that decay wood. And if you had a leak, that's all it takes. As soon as wood gets wet, it is subject to decay by a wide array of fungi, and that's what you were seeing in your apartment. In fact, that's one reason why building contractors go out of their way to try to ensure that water does not get into houses. That's why we replace roofs. That's why we have eaves. That's why we have gutters, is all in an effort to try to prevent water from getting into the wood that we want to shelter us.
But how do mushroom spores get into an apartment? I mean, I could understand it when mushrooms grow on rotting wood in a forest, but in your apartment?
Well, actually, it's possible that those spores were actually there way back when the house was constructed, and that they just lay dormant until they were moistened and were able to germinate and begin decay. It's also possible, I don't know how old your apartment might have been, perhaps it was constructed with wood that hadn't been properly dried. And so the fungus in the wood may have been there from the time it was sawn into lumber, but not dried properly, not completely killed, and again, able to just lie there in a dormant state. Another third possibility is that one way or another, insects happen to carry the spores in. And, of course, insects pick up fungus spores in all kinds of ways, often inadvertently, but they can then carry them and drop them off somewhere along the line.
Now you're really making my day. George Hudler is my guest. He's a professor of plant pathology at Cornell University and author of the new book, Magical Mushrooms, Mischievous Molds. Now, you write in your book that mushrooms used to be viewed as the work of evil spirits. Why?
Oh, just because they showed up so quickly, they came up from underground, they oftentimes had a phallic appearance to them. But probably as much as anything, just the suddenness with which they emerged, literally overnight, you went from nothing to sometimes rather sizable appearances of these bodies.
That is pretty amazing. How do they do that?
Well, actually, much of the body of the mushroom is preformed in a relatively small conglomeration of cells. And what happens is that when they're moistened, then they just expand very rapidly, a little bit like maybe a sponge that's been squeezed together, kind of like the thing you might buy in a gelatin capsule for a kid's bath. And then you put it in and the cells expand when they get wet.
It's really amazing that, some mushrooms are so delicious and others will kill you. Are there any guidelines for recognizing poisonous mushrooms?
Well, there are some general guidelines. I must tell you that I'm a very conservative mushroom hunter myself. And we generally encourage people to stay away from mushrooms that have rings around the stem and white spores and a cup at the base. And it's that last feature that people oftentimes overlook, because the cup is actually more often than not underground. But that's probably those characters, the white spores, the ring, and the base at the bottom, or the cup at the bottom, are probably the three features that I preach about most often as things that you absolutely must avoid, because those mushrooms are deadly poisons. Beyond that, though, I try to encourage people to learn to identify the ones that we know are edible.
Some mushrooms have substances that are hallucinogenic properties. Have you studied that aspect of mushrooms?
I have only studied it in the literature.
No, I'm surprised you wouldn't be curious enough to try it.
Well, I am, as a matter of fact. The problem is that when you do dabble in the hallucinogenic mushroom business, you run the risk of opening up the recesses of your mind and exposing sensations, memories, episodes that you may just as well have left suppressed. And I guess at this point in my life, I'm not quite ready to take that risk. But there are some other things to be concerned about. For instance, if you're not 100% sure of where the hallucinogenic mushrooms you might be thinking about taking come from, you could end up with a really bad experience. There are a number of instances where people have gone out onto the street with a pocket full of money to buy mushrooms. And when they bring those back to the lab, a large proportion are not hallucinogenic mushrooms at all, but they're regular old button mushrooms from the store that are dried and soaked in LSD or PCP or some other much more dangerous group of chemicals. And then, of course, there's also the whole legal aspect of this. The drugs are illegal, and I think for good reason, and so I guess I haven't been so curious yet as to want to dabble in that area.
George Hudler is my guest, author of the new book, Magical Mushrooms, Mischievous Molds. It's a book all about the fungus kingdom. And fungi are just filled with such paradoxes, because on the one hand, they can cause terrible infections. On the other hand, they can cure infections. Like penicillin comes from a fungus mold. And there's a newer medicine that comes from a fungus that's being used for a lot of the migraine treatments. Tell us a little bit about ergot.
Well, ergot has a long history in human affairs. To begin, ergot is a fungus disease of cereal grains, rye, wheat, barley, and the like. And when that fungus infects a plant, it produces a body, a hard seed-like body, that contains a number of chemicals we call alkaloids. Some of those alkaloids have very significant effects on mammalian systems. One of them will actually cause a constriction of blood vessels, so that a person who eats enough of that material can end up with gangrene. But that same chemical given at a regulated dose and a relatively small dose will aid in the treatment of migraine headaches. Another alkaloid in ergot bodies will induce spontaneous abortions, but if used in a regulated dose, can help to induce labor in a difficult pregnancy. And then there are yet others that are precursors. One in particular is a precursor to LSD, and these chemicals will induce convulsions, hallucinations, and a number of other unpleasant reactions.
Now, I'm glad you brought that up, because you say there's been some speculation that the Salem witch trials happened because people probably inadvertently had that kind of ergot and ended up having hallucinations and seizures.
Well, as historians review the history of the Salem witch trials and all that went on during that particular period of time, they note several things. First of all, the so-called bewitched people, which were young girls primarily, lived in that part of Salem that was down along the river. They ate a lot of cereals in their diet, particularly rye. This occurred in a year when weather conditions for plant diseases were particularly good, and it's very likely that a part of their diet may have included some rye that was contaminated with these ergot bodies. Now, these chemicals are known to have a significantly greater effect on teenage children, and the speculation is that upon eating these ergot bodies amidst the regular diet, I mean, they didn't just eat ergot bodies, but they were mixed in with what was presumed to be good rye grain, they got enough of these alkaloids to, in fact, have the hallucinations, have the convulsions, have these other reactions to the alkaloids, which were interpreted by people at the time to be caused by a neighboring witch. And I must emphasize that the role of ergot is still speculative, but I must also say that I'm impressed as historians continue to examine the question that the case gets stronger and stronger for role of ergot as a significant part of this whole episode.
Hmm. Well, George Hudler, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
George Hudler is the author of Magical Mushrooms, Mischievous Molds. He's a professor of plant pathology at Cornell University.